Welcome to the 34 Circe Salon.
Welcome to Make Matriarchy Great Again.
And welcome, everyone, to the 34 Circe Salon. This is the Make Matriarchy Great Again podcast. I am Sean Marlon Newcomb, and I am here with...
Dawn Sam Alden. Welcome, welcome, everyone. Welcome.
Oh, we're excited today, Dawn. We're excited.
Yes, oh, so excited.
I am so glad we get to talk about our beloved Artemis. Oh, the throngs applaud. And Dawn, would you like to introduce our special guest?
Well, Carla Ionescu, we would love you very much to introduce yourself.
Exactly.
We just briefly, Carla came to our attention through the Archaeomythological Society Institute. And she has recently written a book called She Who Hunts about fabulous Artemis. So when we saw that, we were like, oh, yes, we need to have her on the podcast. So, Carla, would you care to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hello, Dawn and Sean. Hello. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Carla Ionescu. My PhD is in ancient history. And as you mentioned, my research and my work is around and on the goddess Artemis, all aspects of the goddess Artemis. I teach at York University in Toronto, Canada. And I mostly teach history and humanities. I also run the Goddess Project podcast, which is a podcast I just started doing just to talk about the goddess and all the things I want to talk about that my students sometimes get a little bit like, okay, Carla, we've heard you for 5 hours. I have also established the Artemis Center virtually, and you can find it online, the Artemis Center. And then, as we talked about earlier, I hope to have it built as a real physical space. And what else can I tell you about me? You can find me online anywhere at Artemis Expert. Right now, I am the leading, let's say, academic working solely on the worship of Artemis around the world. So very excited to talk about her with you guys.
Oh, I'm very excited to talk about you, too.
This is very exciting. First of all, can I just ask you right off the bat, how did you get so devoted to Artemis? What drew you to her? When did it happen? That kind of thing. What's the background of that?
Well, okay. So it's a little bit unromantic in a way. It was, I would say, one of those love affairs that started slow and built to now an almost impossible separation. When I grew up Catholic, and so I was very devoted to the Virgin Mary. And when I went to university, one of my first degree was in religious studies and women's studies. And I kind of, in doing religious studies, my Christian faith broke apart. Yeah. And then I spent some years looking, you know, studying things, et cetera, trying to figure out what to do with my life. I got a bunch of degrees. I got 3. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to go do my master's. And for my master's, my supervisor said, you know, pick something that you really enjoy doing, because you've had, you know, you spent all this time getting these other degrees. What do you really enjoy doing? So I thought, you know what, I'm going to reach back to the Virgin Mary and then see if I can trace, you know, the worship of the Virgin Mary backwards. And as I started doing that, I bumped into a bunch of other goddesses, but I kept bumping into Artemis, particularly Artemis of Ephesus. And so I did a short paper for my master's. And they really loved it. And they thought, this is really cool. And I had this long sort of, I don't know, moment of what am I doing with my life? Am I going to law school? Am I going to get my PhD? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like a professional student, as they say.
I love it.
Nothing wrong with that.
And I decided to go do my PhD. And in doing that, because I had kind of lost myself down this rabbit hole, you know, with Artemis, and I thought, here's a good opportunity to research a goddess or a divinity that the classicists, the historians, humanity, you know, all of anthropologists had sort of dismissed, you know? And I just became obsessed with her. The more I found out, the more I got defensive of her, in the sense of like, how is it possible that a goddess could be this influential, this powerful, this significant, and no one has talked about her? And I'm looking up things from 1960s because no one has talked about her in the last 20 years. And
we have a similar experience, Carla, with everything we talk about on this podcast. Anything with women's history, women's warriors, goddesses, it's just overlooked. And somehow, there's, for some strange reason, nobody talks about it.
So, right?
Yeah, we feel you.
It's fascinating. And then what happened was she started showing up for me everywhere.
Nice. So
if I went to dinner somewhere, there'd be an Artemis thing on the menu. If I traveled somewhere that had nothing to do with it, she'd show up in a garden. She started doing this thing that was like everywhere. I went to go visit my cousin in New Jersey, and she knows, you know, she goes, oh, you're into Artemis. I say, she goes, oh, there's some graffiti, you know, down the road of Artemis. And I thought, she goes, you want to come see it? And I thought, okay, some graffiti, probably an arrow and, you know, some kind of a thing. We drive down, and there's this two-floor, stunning, beautiful piece of Artemis of Ephesus. Like,
wow.
Screaming at me. Like, I said, this is not graffiti, doofus. This is art.
Yeah.
Just random. Like, you know, we're in New Jersey and some, you know, it's just random stuff. And I had a few people when I was telling them to say, you know, that's very unusual, right?
It's very unusual. I don't know about a lot of people making, you know, art, street art of Artemis. So
Artemis of Ephesus, it was just, and so this was happening so regular that I started realizing this may not be just coincidence. This may be sort of a guidance into this field. And then, I finished my PhD in 2016. And even after that, I was still very much an academic mind. I wasn't yet committed to her, let's say, spiritually. Maybe I was, and I was just in denial. Who knows? I don't know. But during COVID, I stayed home. I was teaching online, and I wanted to really publish this small book on the Greek Artemis because I have this idea of doing about 6 different books on her from different regions of the world. You know, and I have this kind of plan, like a little series, you know?
Right, yeah.
But I couldn't find an academic publisher that really had my vision. And then they wanted 2 to 3 years. And to be honest, they also don't want to pay you. And they had a different vision of, you know, like, again, oh, Artemis, I don't know, maybe tie her into this or do this. And I thought, no. And I decided to self-publish, you know, which in academia is a bit frowned upon.
Right.
But I thought, you know what? I have to do all the work myself and promote myself, and I can do it myself. And I did. And when I did that, like, all these people came out of the woodwork, these Artemis enthusiasts and goddess groups and just people that loved her so much, because I had to go on social media and, like, you know, create a brand and step outside my little library space.
Right.
And that just, oh my God, it's just been a whirlwind since then. I'm so excited to have so many people that care for her and are drawn to her the way that I am.
That is really wonderful to hear. That is really, really wonderful to hear.
Yeah.
That there's that many. Because again, I get super excited. And I have to say too, that, I mean, I am a practicing Catholic. So I'm obviously interested in the Mary aspect of this too, but it's just those, but the goddess herself, you know, the different regions, and I'll try to contain my over enthusiasm.
That's all right. The whole purpose of the podcast is to squee over Artemis. So we're
exactly.
Good.
Exactly. I certainly want to explore the Mary aspect in Ephesus, but let's maybe for the listener, could you give maybe just a real quick snapshot of who Artemis is, at least maybe in the classical cultural sense that we would know or most people would have engaged her in. And then maybe we can use that to kind of lead into wherever you want to go with her, you know, whichever one you want to explore of her manifestations?
Yeah. So traditionally, I would say that the most popular version of Artemis, especially in the West, is the hunter goddess. So usually that statue that has the young maiden in a short skirt, in a short skirt with her, either her bow, carrying her bow or her bow drawn, and maybe either dogs beside her or maybe a deer beside her. And I think she's often in popular culture, certainly like in film, and Percy Jackson, things like that, she is often depicted as like a young woman, you know, I don't know, age-wise, maybe 18 to 22, things like that. And I think that that's usually, and even in a lot of the classicists' write-ups about her, they always mention her as a maiden, you know, young maiden. And I know that sometimes maiden and virgin sort of overlap, but her youth and her naiveness, I mean, Homer kind of makes her look almost like a child, you know, because Hera apparently smacks her and she cries and runs away.
Yeah, what was that about? Whenever I read that passage, I get annoyed.
Yeah. You know, I think that Homer has issues, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, we know. Yes, we know.
To put it mildly, yes.
And so I think that she's often dismissed as like a petulant child, you know, and then we're told that she sits on Zeus's lap and has all these demands. And of course, he accepts all of her demands. And I think so she's often represented that way, certainly in the last, I don't know, couple hundred years, she's been represented that way. And I think that's what people are most familiar with. And to be honest, that's what I was expecting when I first began, like I said, for the master's degree, when I saw Artemis over and over again, I thought, what does this have to do with the hunter goddess? Like, what is this, you know? And I think that's what piqued my interest. And then I kind of fell down that rabbit hole of research. Yeah.
Well, let's go down the rabbit hole with you.
One of the things that we have looked at with various, particularly goddesses in the Greek and Roman pantheons is that, you know, they have this long history. The goddess that we are familiar with now often came from much larger breadth and scope than we are familiar with. We looked at with Aphrodite, how, you know, she has these roots in being a war and sex goddess. You know, how Hera was so much more broadly loved than we see, you know, the end result of the nagging, henpecking wife who's, you know, punishes women for her husband's transgressions, that kind of thing. So we know that Artemis had a much richer and broader past than this, you know, bratty girl that we see in Homer. So can you sort of walk us backwards in time and show us more of who she was before the misogynist patriarchal Greek culture got a hold of her?
I think so. So some of it is a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for? It's difficult sometimes to pin down goddesses when you go into the Neolithic and the pre-Neolithic period. You know, all of them, I mean, some of them perhaps reach back a little further. Artemis is a very fascinating goddess because her name is quite unique and it's not Greek. But it's also very difficult to pin her down to a pre-Greek period because there's so much lore around the mistress of animals and a mistress of the wilds. And she, and for example, in Crete, you know, there's Britomartis, there's Dictina, there's other goddesses. Sometimes Artemis is associated with Hecate, Cybele, Neith in Egypt. So the qualities, I think, of Artemis can be traced back, of course, pre-Greek. But as an academic, I say that with a slight caution in the sense that her name is not, you know, it's not Artemis, the mistress of animals. That becomes later. But her qualities, which I think this is the way that we trace most goddesses, is through either symbolism or their qualities or what they're protective or what they represent. And so Artemis has often been associated, or I would say the earliest that we can trace her back, and we can go back almost 7,000 years to the mistress of animals, at least in depiction. And that's sort of usually a goddess, a woman, let's say a female figure holding two animals, usually by the tail or by the neck in her hands, you know?
Where does that come? Just in a broad sense, because it's, you know, on this podcast, we talk a lot about the old Europe matriarchies and the idea of that there are kinds of civilizations that existed before, the kinds of things, of course, that people ignore and pretend didn't actually exist, like we've talked about. So with this symbolism of this goddess of or mistress of animals, first, I guess that's the first question is, what regions are we talking about where we see this? Is this in Anatolia? Is this that kind of thing? And what do we think is the source of it? Is it like a mother goddess cult, or is it just one of a pantheon?
Those are very good questions. Okay, so the areas, the geographical areas, I would say Mesopotamia, there's a couple of pieces. There is also a couple of pieces of a mister of animals. I don't like mentioning him often. I have to be fair.
It doesn't even sound good, so...
Or is a mister or a master of animals, much like much smaller and much fewer depictions of him. But and so I would say Mesopotamia, Anatolia for sure, what is now defined as the Mediterranean. And we have found either medallions or plates with this image. I'm trying to think what other pieces, and of course some vases and other pieces as well. It's fascinating because the image is similar in the sense that you have this female figure, sometimes with a gorgon head, especially if we get look at the Minoans and the Mycenaeans later, or sometimes just with a human head, holding on to these two animals, sometimes standing on two lions, which is very much Ishtar, Inanna. Right. So there's a blending there of divine responsibility. And it's unclear where this figure stands in the pantheon because we don't have a written source in which she, let's say, is placed, you know, in some kind of hierarchy or in some kind of pantheon. The reason why we know she seems so popular is because there's a plethora of pieces with this figure on them. And so it's like over and over and over and over, we find her on seals. We find her, you know, over and over again. So most archaeologists will say, well, this seemed to be a really popular divinity, even though she doesn't have a specific name other than the mistress of animals. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is as we move forward through time, that mistress of animals becomes associated with Artemis, and the fact that the Greeks, wherever they're conquering, they go, oh yeah, we have a goddess that's about animals and hunting and wilderness. Her name's Artemis. So they name that mistress of animals Artemis.
Right.
Now the debate is whether or not the Artemis that then is labeled the mistress of animals embodies or sort of swells with the symbolism and divinities of multicultures, right?
Right.
And perhaps that's what makes her such a significant goddess over time, is that she's really kind of almost like growing with the different responsibilities and the layers of cultures that she adapts to or takes over, you know?
Right. She's sort of gathering attributes as she goes along. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then she becomes the protector of children, and then she becomes a midwife goddess. All the while holding animals, wildlife, hunting, you know, so and then in Ephesus, I would say she swells into it sort of this magnificence, which is really an all-encompassing goddess, you know, everything from fertility to nurturing to fruit to animals, etc. Right.
Right. Yeah.
It's she is one of the goddesses that evolves, that shapes. I find her the most fascinating, the most independent. I would call her an early feminist goddess, obviously before feminist was a word, because she just lives and owns everything.
Yeah.
She owns everything.
Yeah. I mean, one of the aspects, I did a play this summer where we looked at, it was a dramatization of the Amazons that went to the Trojan War. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of investigation of sort of what was Artemis to the Amazons. And one of the things we looked at was that she is often associated with wildness.
Yes.
So there is something about her that as the sort of quote unquote civilized world, the known world around the Mediterranean started to be more and more Hellenized, more and more brought under patriarchal systems of rule.
Yes.
There would be something, I think, incredibly appealing to specifically women, but also men, in a goddess that could not be tamed.
Yes. Yes.
That represented this sense of wildness.
Yes.
That's a great phrase, Dawn. Goddess who could not be tamed. Okay.
I love that. And I was thinking of that word as you were saying that, Dawn. Untamed. She's untamed. And also she's sovereign of her own body.
Yes.
Right? She's sovereign. She is not, in one way, she is the only goddess with no responsibilities in the sense of Hera is given marriage, you know, Aphrodite is given and the sex, Demeter is given motherhood and agriculture. Artemis has the wild, yes, it's sort of the wild is her domain, but she remains a goddess that bows to no one, answers to no one, owes no one anything. And, you know, if you think about that, I mean, that's quite a feat for a goddess to survive through a patriarchal reframing of pantheons.
Yes.
And I also think this is why she escaped the notice of classicists or classical scholars for a long time, because they just didn't see her. They just couldn't relate to her. You know, like they looked at Athena and thought, oh, a warrior goddess, fantastic. I can relate to that. Or Demeter, mother goddess, or Aphrodite, lots of sex, or whatever.
Right.
And I have a feeling that they looked at Artemis and thought, eh, you know. And so she remained almost untouched by interpretation to some degree. I mean, a little dismissed, yes, but untouched in many, many ways and unchanged. And so today, now, we can really look at her and she's so relevant to us in this time, right? Like she's... Right. And men and women are drawn because we're all drawn to the wildness, to nature. Right. And so everyone is drawn to her and she is able to fulfill something, I think, in all of us that I'm not sure, at least speaking for myself, I'm not sure that another goddess could. Not so completely, perhaps. Not so completely.
I want to just before to continue with that, just to go touch back a little bit on the Amazons. As Dawn and some of the listeners of this podcast know, I am a true believer of the Amazons. I do believe one of my goals is to prove that there was this existent tribe. But putting that aside a little bit, what do we know of, at least in whatever classical literature or what, how exactly were the Amazons? Is there any, perhaps a better way to put this, is there any sort of classical literature that shows what the Greeks thought the Amazons did in terms of their worship of the goddess or how they were connected to Artemis? Are there any specific details about that, or is that more just a generalized conjecture?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. So we have some primary source, particularly around Artemis of Ephesus, although I would argue that the arrows and the hunting and the warrior and protectiveness character of Artemis is often echoed in the Greek's interpretation of the Amazons. But in the case of Artemis of Ephesus, we are told that the Amazons literally carried the cult statue, the initial cult statue, which was made of wood, we are told, so therefore we don't have it anymore, into what then became Ephesus. So pre the establishment of the city, it was the Amazons that came and established, they were running away from some other tribe and came and established a space where they left or placed the cult statue in a grove, which then later on becomes the place where her temple is built. And that this was a straight sort of a, imagine a, almost like a 2x4 cult statue, because the cult statues in the ancient world used to be just literally a piece of plywood, sometimes with nothing else on it than just a piece of wood. Mm-hmm. And that they placed this cult statue in this grove, and that they, this was their goddess that they worshipped, and that they started to build the initial space, the initial sacred space where eventually Ephesus and the more complex statue of Artemis of Ephesus was built. So there is a direct correlation between Artemis and the Amazons. And there are lots of other Greek authors that that claim that Artemis was the goddess of the Amazons. And I think that that has a lot to do with the arrow and the archery. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very direct correlation. I also believe that the Amazons were real figures, and I think that will eventually come to light in archaeology.
We will talk about that off air, Carl. that is like my life's goal. So there we go.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we have so many examples of warrior women, of archery using women, that we found already, and I have no doubt that at some point we'll find something that correlates that, but. But either way, I think that there were women, I don't know if we want to call them independent women, or I don't know if I want to call them warrior women. I had this discussion with my brother last night because he's like, oh, there were women warriors who also wanted to fight. And I was saying, no, they were defending themselves. And so sometimes when you say warrior woman, I think the implication is that they were conquering.
Right.
Right.
But there's a big difference between offensive war and defensive war.
Exactly.
Huge difference. Yeah.
Exactly. And while I think historically speaking, there were warrior women, because, you know, there had to be, and obviously we also have DNA evidence of this in graves. But I think initially these women, certainly that the Greeks are talking about, are really in defensive war, right? Like they're really trying to just live their lives. Yeah. And they're being slowly, you know, kicked out of their spaces, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm not sure that I've ever heard of another goddess. I mean, they probably worship several goddesses at the time, but I would say that most of the time, if you read most pieces about the Amazons, there's a direct connection to Artemis somewhere in there. And so I think I could comfortably say that Artemis would have been one of the major goddesses of the Amazons for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems just a natural connection.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. And there are some scholars that will say that in fact, the Amazons brought Artemis as the hunter goddess. You know how, so for example, if we have the mistress of animals, the mistress of animals is not a hunter. Right? She's more of a protector of animals. And there are scholars that have argued that when the Amazons came from wherever they came from, most people say they came from the north down into the Mediterranean, but who knows?
Yeah.
That they brought this hunter goddess. And in the Balkans and in like Norway and Scandinavia, there is a hunter goddess. There's lots of hunter goddess lore there. So there are some that argue that they brought a hunter goddess down, let's say, and that the mix of the hunter goddess and the mistress of animals created this concept of Artemis.
Wow, that is really interesting.
Right? I mean, this is a possibility. Again, I mean, we're talking about a time when we don't really have any, well, we certainly have no written culture, right? Even from the Amazons, let's say. So all we have is the Greeks telling us about them. But it's an interesting idea, you know, that they might have brought the hunter aspect into the culture. And then people might have gone, oh, well, we have a goddess that takes care of animals and the wilds. This fits really well. And so that kind of blend. And I feel like that's the mystery that I'm constantly chasing too. It's like trying to decipher this puzzle of this complex divinity, knowing that I probably never will.
Right, Right. There are so many aspects, and over such a long period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking millennia.
Yes.
Where people's moved and things changed and yes. climates changed and cultures changed. So, yeah, I mean, I think the fact to hold on to is yes. that the concept of the mistress of animals was so prevalent in so many spaces, in so many forms.
Yes.
And it makes perfect sense. I mean, these are hunter-gatherer peoples.
Mm-hmm.
So their relationship with animals was a matter of survival.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now, especially now that we're learning, I mean, I feel like I've known it forever, but all now that we're learning that hunter-gatherers were both men and women, so that women exactly. and men hunted, right?
Yeah,
and
it wasn't a gender-specific
right.
Occupation. It was the occupation of everyone in the culture.
Right, which makes sense, right? Anyone yeah. who can.
Anyone who can would, absolutely. When you
exactly.
resources are finite, yeah. you don't see a lot of people that are decorative.
That's right. That's right. And so then that would make sense that the mistress of animals or a hunter goddess predates maybe many of the other goddesses. I mean, this is now showing my favoritism, but many of the other goddesses, you know, maybe other than fertility goddesses, which of course are also very important to the tribe or the village. But then it would have made sense that they would have some type of hunter divinity that, you know, let's say pre-Neolithic people would have been worshiping even earlier than the word Artemis comes into play. You know?
Yes, yes. And I might, you know, you mentioned that there was a presence of a mister of animals, but but it was not nearly as prevalent. I love that, by the way.
That's got to be a skit. We've got to make a skit out of the mister of animals. It's gonna be, like a TV host.
You know it just, mister of animals. But it just strikes me once again that, you know, this incredibly ubiquitous, important figure in a hunter-gatherer peoples is coded as female.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, in our current patriarchal society, we're like, men are hunters. Men go out and kill the big animals with their big, strong muscles, big, big, strong men, hunter men. And it's
yeah.
like, well, no, if you look at the figures that were present, they were female
yes.
figurines.
We've been sold a bill of lies.
Yes indeed.
Yes, indeed. Yes. And I, you know, I was saying to someone this morning, the goddess is our natural divinity, you
yes.
know?
Yeah.
Humans are drawn to the sacred feminine, especially around the earth, caves, animals. In that relationship, there seems to be the sacred feminine takes priority. Of course, we have some consort gods like the master of animals, you know, we have lots of male consorts that, you know, are sacrificed yearly or every 6 years in the case of the Minoans, willingly sacrificed, by the way,
right.
you know, not by force, but yeah, it seems like, let's say for our entire, I don't know how long Homo sapiens have been on the planet, let's say 100,000 years, that our natural inclination tends to be towards a sacred feminine. And then other stories yeah. of heroes and other peoples are added on. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all that early hunter-gatherers would have had a sacred feminine hunter goddess, and then perhaps, you know, some others in the shape of like maybe an animal god and some other, you know, key players in there as well.
Well, it's probably a good way to segue into what you had alluded to with Mary, so, and that's her mm-hmm. feminine divine. So how is Artemis connected in that sense?
So in the worship of the Virgin Mary, I would say that the connection is stronger between Artemis of Ephesus and Mary more than the Greek Artemis, which, let's say for the purpose of definition, we would call the hunter Artemis or the Amazon's mm-hmm. Artemis. Although there's some overlap, but what Mary inherits from Artemis is this idea of nurturing, This idea of the only thing that actually Mary does that Artemis never does is birth a child, you know?
Right. Her own child. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, but Mary is associated with bees, for example, and honey and milk, which the Ephesian Artemis, you know, how she has that statue that is covered in bees' eggs. Mm-hmm. I know there's a debate. I don't know if it's still happening. I've been trying to shut it down for a couple of years. There's a debate that they're bull's testicles. So my next book is actually on Artemis of Ephesus, and I'm going to have a couple of chapters where it's just pure. No, it isn't. It is bees. It is bees.
Listen to me when I tell you this is what it is.
I feel like I've studied bees. You know, I should get a degree in like biology. I don't know what. Because I've studied bees for so long, you know, what kind of eggs did they have? What does the queen bee egg look like? That, you know, to prove this point and to add sort of evidence. But certainly the statue of Artemis of Ephesus has bees coming up the side and then beehives or bee eggs. And so this association with honey, this idea of virginity, the concept of nurturing children, of feeding the world. Also in Ephesus, where the temple of Artemis is, right beside it, well, okay, a walk away, is the house of Mary, where we're told that Mary was taken there by John and that she passed away in this house. So there's a sort of overlapping of sacred space. It is also in Ephesus in 431, where the Ephesians were very, very excited that the church named Mary Theotokos in the city of Ephesus. Theotokos, of course, meaning the mother of God, which was a very controversial thing to do at the time. And there was a lot of controversy around it.
Right. It was the question of mother of Christ versus mother of God, I think.
And so when you name a goddess Theotokos, you are when you name a woman Theotokos, you are implying that she's a goddess in some way.
Right.
Or a divine being, you know, the carrier of God. And so all of this happens in Ephesus. And so there's a deep connection. Now, other scholars do connect Mary to, for example, Kybele, which is a goddess that stretches back a little bit further as well. And so sometimes Mary does embody a few different aspects of different goddesses. The one thing that the Virgin Mary, of course, gives up is sovereignty and independence. She kind of leans towards that motherhood, purity, kind of on a pedestal devotion, where Artemis, let's say, was more of an independent figure, a wrathful figure. I mean, you didn't want to piss her off because you'd
right.
end up, right?
Yeah.
So I would say,
eaten by your dog.
That's right. That's right. So Mary does not inherit that. And of course, that's purposely done. Mary does not inherit those qualities of Artemis, but the protector of children. Artemis in Ephesus, one of her names is Queen of Thrones. And sometimes Mary is a queen on a throne or the Queen of Heaven. So there's some name overlap as well. Artemis is also sometimes called Soteria or Savior. And so she has a salvation quality to her. So there's a lot of overlap between the two. But I would say that because Mary was adapted more intentionally for the purpose of a structured religion, her attributes are selected. Yes. You know what I mean? And so I would say that whoever selected those attributes had the privilege of taking out anything that was a little more rebellious or certainly a little more feminist. And so I think
certainly her untamed nature.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Right. So for myself, when I was a child, I grew up Catholic and I was very devoted to the Virgin Mary, like very, very devoted. And when I became a pagan and I sort of devoted myself to Artemis and the goddess is the great divine, I kind of look back sometimes and I thought, oh man, I really wish I had this spirituality when I was a kid. I think it would have been more liberating. And then I think to myself, well, I spent my childhood and my teenage years devoted to Mary, and she was the only sacred feminine available to me. So in a way, I suppose one could argue that I've been worshiping the goddess my whole life, you know, just right, just in the only way that was available at that time.
Yeah, it's we did a wonderful interview, oh goodness, years back now, with poet Caitlin Shetler, and yeah. she was escape in the process of escaping from evangelical Christianity. Mm-hmm. She talked about how the yearning for some sort of female divine was yeah. so strong, and that, you know, the evangelical group that she had been raised in had scrubbed every female figure out of their worship that they possibly could. Mary was there, but she was so distant and yeah. so sort of uninvolved, and that she, part of her dissatisfaction was from this yearning for some sort of feminine aspect of the divine. And I think that, you know, as we said earlier, that is so a part of who we are as spirit and blood and bone and Homo sapiens sapien. We are so drawn to that, yeah. that all attempts throughout our history to remove it, they can't last.
Yes.
Because it's so counter to what we need.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think that, at, you know, we lived in harmony under these sort of matriarchal cultures. I mean, that's a big word for the entire world, but this sort of matrifocal cultures. And we all lived, well, certainly we thrived because we're still here, right? And so we must have lived in some collaborative way in order to have survived in all over the world, you know, and prospered. And then I think in the last 5,000 years, maybe 10, if we want to push it, patriarchy has kind of, I don't know, perhaps unintentionally sort of changed that, and not for the better. Yes, And so I do believe that the return of the patriarchy is imminent. It is coming. It is happening.
The return of the matriarchy.
Yes. And that's sort of also my continuous message, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, look at the name of this podcast.
Exactly.
So, yeah. What we did a podcast takeover where the guest being interviewed was a trauma therapist. And she talked real briefly about the development of the human brain, like the biochemical development of the human brain, uh-huh. and how we could not be these big brain, giant frontal cortex. We could not be Homo sapiens sapien if we had developed in patriarchy.
Oh, fascinating.
In order for our brains to develop the way they did, we needed the kind of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of ability to nurture front and center, like cultures that were focused on nurturing,
uh-huh.
that comes from matriarchy.
Wow.
Blew my mind. Yeah.
That's incredible. I love it when scientific research and sort of mythological research comes together.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, can we talk about some of the other regional aspects, the regional incarnations of Artemis, because we've talked about Ephesus, and now we've got, you know, the Mistress of the Hunt. So what about some other regions that where you see her?
Particularly like Crete, we would love to hear. Yeah.
Yes. So Crete is fascinating to me. Obviously, I'm moving there. I feel like there is magic on that island. I mean, I've traveled a lot for research, both during the PhD and after. And when I got to Crete, I had this really visceral reaction to the island. It felt like home. You know, when you have some places where you just feel like this is the place for you. I started writing poetry there. I went to a couple of caves that really felt even for my sort of skeptic brain, the first time I went to Greece, to Crete, I was a little bit still, you know, in that kind of brain of like, no, no, she's not real. Just, you know, do your research and, you know. And I would go to places that had these echoes of just power in a way that was unexplained. And then because my research was Artemis, there were so many spaces for her there. And as I studied more and more about the Minoans, I realized what a good fit she was. Now, there are some arguments, of course, that the Mycenaeans arrived in Crete and attached the word Artemis to goddesses like Britomartis and Dictina and the unnamed, because there's a few unnamed goddesses or goddesses whose names we don't know in Minoan Crete. And I do kind of agree to that, but I think the essence of the goddess in her power, which I will label now Artemis, was there already in Crete. So it would not have been a big leap for the Mycenaeans to arrive and go, oh, out of all of our pantheons, this one fits here best, right? You know? And so the Minoans had a goddess, or also Eileithyia, who is the goddess of childbirth, Britomartis, who is a goddess that jumped into the sea, Dictina, also a sea goddess, because they're an island people,
right?
So there's a lot, and then there's a mountain goddesses because they have mountains as well. So they have the mistress of animals, not surprising because they have a huge wilderness. And there's several temples to her that have been labeled, and then there's several spaces or caves that are possibilities. There is a place that I found up in a mountain of Artemis Rokia, who we only know her name, and we don't know very much about why this space was named after her. When I climbed up the mountain to the ruins were Roman, you know, so they were kind of late. And so again, another mystery that I'll have to go back and dig through and see. One of the problems is that she is so much everywhere, and every village, not just in Crete, but all over, like for example, Greece and Italy and Turkey, every village has a different name for her and not so much written material. And so you really have to speak to the locals a little bit, or find some of the locals that still remember some of the stories. And again, you know, from an archaeological perspective, that's a tough one to put down in a publication. As a conversation, yes, we can, you know, totally talk about that. But and so for me, that has been some of the challenge. For example, when I went to Brawn, and this is a different site just outside of Athens. The first time I went to Brawn, it was barely visited. Even my tour guide had no idea what I was talking about. And this was about 15 years ago, you know? And I was like, no, there's a site to Artemis. I know there is. It's over here, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. We've never been there. Okay. So then I found it. And when I went there, I had known that it was a site where, a lot of young women were initiated into, let's say, adulthood. And I knew that it was a site of ritual. But I met a local woman who was telling me a story about how each of the there are columns at the temple. There were 40 columns. And she was telling me that each of the column was a different week of pregnancy, you know, and that women used to give birth here and there. There's no literal evidence of this. So I can't back that up. But when I was talking to her, you know, she was saying to me, this has been passed down for generations. We've always known this is a sacred site for birthing and things like that. And so I'm finding, I mean, this summer, I'm going to begin creating my own Google map of all the temples for her.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm going to start in Crete and Eastern Greece. And I'm going to photograph the spaces and add my own photographs and descriptions and see what comes up. I have a feeling there's going to be at least 300 temples. That's my estimation, my hypothesis. But it's going to take a little while because obviously it's a big project. But I'm determined to see, you know, and to prove all of the ways in which people connected to her in almost every village and built her a little something. And I guess I just want to prove what I'm saying, that she is the most significant goddess of the ancient world, you know, mm-hmm. the most influential. And right now, the evidence that we have is a bit limited, you know.
Just as a,
but those are some of my favorite places, like in Crete. So there's a couple of caves that say, yeah, we think Artemis was worshipped here, but they don't say why or where there's any evidence or anything like that. And so a lot of local lore. In Greece, of course, there's different areas like Baron, Sparta, for example. I don't know that people know that the Spartans worshipped Artemis.
See, okay,
this and is they worshipped her in the most bloodiest and goriest of ways. It's one of my favorite things, you know, to talk about when I give lectures, because I didn't know that the Spartans' main goddess was Artemis.
I think
that they have this temple in Sparta that's still standing. Well, pieces of it are still standing, you know, where they used to bleed themselves in for her. So a really bloody, actually, goddess. And there's a couple of ancient writers that say that they used to even sacrifice humans for her there. So lots of
spaces. The Spartans had some issues.
Spartans have a very weird thing
really
around
loved,
that.
Like, gore, you know. But what's fascinating is that they pick Artemis, so not Athena. Well, it would have been, it says not Athena, because obviously for a time they didn't like the Athenians very much. But they pick Artemis and they would soak her statue, her cult statue, in their blood. You know, they would whip themselves into a frenzy and soak the cult statue in their blood before they went, you know, before they went on. So it's quite fascinating that the Spartans were doing that. Yeah.
I want to ask a couple of things about both the Spartans, but also the Minoans, the Cretans. So did you find in your study of the Cretans that there was, you know, there's the argument of, well, was this really a female-centric society? Of course, we don't argue that, but that's, you hear that in scholarship.
I can't hear anyone.
Okay. Can you not hear me? Okay. Hold on.
Carla, can you hear me? Sean, why don't you pause the recording for a sec?
And we return from technical difficulty. So we were talking about the Spartans. I had a question about the Spartans and the Minoans. So two questions, two parts. All right.
Okay.
So Minoans, what I was curious about is what, because we talk a lot about their female-centric culture, what kind of pantheon or goddess-like pantheon they had. Just out of curiosity, I know it's a little off Artemis, but do we find that they were more goddesses than gods in their pantheon? Was it a female-centric? And then second, for the Spartans, I think it's interesting that for their hyper-emphasis on masculinity, there are some very interesting, strange matriarchal things, like the double goddess or double queen. They have a double king, and they allow women to, you know, sort of get physical training and, you know, education. So let's maybe just focus on the Minoan part. So what else, just in a general sense, do you discover about the Minoan pantheon that maybe would be informative for both Artemis and for the other things we know about the Greco-Roman pantheon?
So for the Minoans have been a slight point of contention for me recently. So one of the things that comes up a lot that I've sort of started to change my language around
is this idea
that they had palaces.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
And this is very much an Arthur Evans ideology. And it's been contested, and there's lots of problems around Arthur Evans' work. And
so for the listener, he's the discoverer, quote unquote.
Kenosis. Yeah. And, you know, there's problematics with the archaeology, and I don't want to put it all on him because, you know, it was a period of the time and there was complications, etc. But when he saw the structures that the Minoans built, he called them palaces. He then bought into the story of King Minos, which is, of course, a Mycenaean story.
And a myth.
And a myth, of course. He bought into this whole figure. And so lately what's been going on right now, superficial, but hopefully also later on with more and more academic work, is that we're really looking at some of the spaces and going, well, there's actually no evidence that they were palaces. There's no evidence that they had a monarchy. And by evidence, I mean archaeological or material culture. There's no evidence of any of that. What we see evidence of is that they had a priesthood, that they had female goddesses, and we see these in seals, in coins, in, of course, pottery, everywhere else, that they had a pantheon of unnamed goddesses, to be honest. We know there was a goddess to the sea. We know there was a bee goddess. We know there's a butterfly double axe connection and symbolism. And different names are attached to them over time, especially, like I said, especially once the Mycenaeans and the Greeks arrived there. And so lately there's been, so for example, even the throne room, you know, he reshaped the throne room and he calls it a throne room, but it's really just a stone chair. And so anyone could have sat. Perhaps it's not a throne, perhaps it's a high priestess space, or perhaps right. It's just a place where someone sat. And in fact, if you go visit Knossos and you talk to some of the ladies that run the place over there, they will say that sometimes when it's, because I go a lot in December, which is usually dead, no one's there. And they will say that when they close down or when it's very, very quiet, the guards will allow some of the women to sit on the so-called throne room. And if you make a wish or you send a prayer to the goddess there, it will come true. So it's like a local superstition.
Wonderful.
It's really nice. It's really cute. I have not yet convinced them to let me go sit on the throne, but.
Well, it also kind of makes me think of a classroom.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
So the Minoans then had a very, I'm fascinated by their culture because it was certainly a matriarchy or matri focused. So that means they had at least three or four goddesses and a few consorts. And there may have been an early Dionysian or what we would call a suffering god or a sacrifice god. And there's this belief that, of course, the Minotaur, Asterion, was one of their gods, not a monster.
Right.
Usually the consort to the goddess. So I'm fascinated to almost like rediscover them. You know, I think there's a lot of room to learn from them. Their building structure showed that they live together. There is very little evidence of class. Like people go, well, they have a building and obviously the rich lived in the buildings and the poor farmed. And I'm like, is that obvious?
Right.
I'm not sure that is that not an assumption, you know? And so there's a lot to sort of revive there, which I really like. Of course, until we decipher, you know, linear AA2, we're a little bit stuck because we don't know exactly their language. But, and so I think that Artemis, and there's a temple to Leto up in the mountains as well. And of course, you know, there's the cave of Zeus where he was supposedly hidden and raised
away from Kronos, his father.
Right? Yeah. So there's lots of mystery on this island. Like I said, a lot of it is brought by the Mycenaeans and later on by the Greeks. But I think that in the case of Artemis, she, again, fits so well with their mistress of animals. We found lots of evidence of the mistress of animals in Minoan Crete. And so we think that they definitely had a mistress of the wild and the wild mountains and things like that. And that would have been one of their main divinities. But so far as names, other than Asterion, sometimes people will look at constellation names and things like that. But a lot of that is brought by people who practice Minoan religion today. There are groups that would call themselves Minoan spiritualists. And they have their own calendar and they have some rituals, but they come to those traditions mostly through archaeological discoveries and intuitive learning. So how do you quantify intuitive learning? Like, how do you say, yes, this is true? You can't really do that, right?
It's more of a spiritual path where you receive knowledge through whatever.
Which I think is valid for them. And
absolutely.
But you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. But like you say, you can't write a scientific paper on that. Yeah, exactly. It's sort of two different streams of knowledge.
Yeah. But we have lots of jewelry. We have lots of seals, lots of representation of the goddesses, especially bees and butterfly goddesses. And we also have, well, as you know, some of the frescoes. So we do have quite a bit of visual evidence. Nothing that supports a monarchy, unless you're making assumptions when you're looking at the frescoes. So it's an interesting new-ish field, I think. I don't know if everyone's comfortable with sort of looking at it that way, but there is pressure to start saying, was there a monarchy? What's your evidence, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah, and I like that I'm seeing more often the referred to as Cretan rather than Minoan.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. I know Vicky says that.
Yeah, yeah, Vicky says that. Yeah, since, you know, naming a culture after an imported myth rather than the indigenous people that lived there. Yes.
An imported myth about a man who was a king. So.
Exactly.
Yes. 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 So I think that's really exciting. Like I said, I think there's every time I post a video on social media about this, I always get some dudes.
No, really?
It's true. There's always some dudes that are like,
you mean when a woman speaks words on the internet, some guys get upset?
Yeah.
Really?
What are your credentials for this? And where have you seen this in, you know, academic articles?
Oh my God.
I try my best not to engage. I have this policy that I will explain something to you once. And then if you're really aggressive, I'm just going to be like, okay.
Yeah, so it's because they're not actually looking for information. They're looking for confrontation. You know? Yeah, exactly.
And I don't mind it. Like, I don't mind people to go, well, I don't know. That sounds maybe a little too new for me. Like, just, you know, I don't mind that. But sometimes it gets a little aggressive. But there is this sort of push now. And that's across a lot of archaeological finds and a lot of other issues, other places as well. For me, it's really wonderful to learn more about it and maybe approach it from a different perspective. And then also, I try to do that for Artemis as well. Like when somebody goes, well, this belongs to Artemis, then I would really like to dig backwards and go, okay, when, how, who put her here? I think that's just my natural inclination is to try and go back to the source as much as I can, you know? But in Crete, it's unclear. So I'm going to say that the term Artemis came with the Mycenaeans and later with the Greeks. Not that this was a Cretan / Minoan goddess, but that is still up in the air. I'm going back in April and I'm going to continue digging. In fact, I think I'm going to write one of the series for this series of books on Artemis will be Artemis in Crete, because I think there's just so much there to talk about.
Nice.
That will be. And Sean, I'm sorry, I forgot your second question about
the Spartans. I was just following up on what you had said about the Spartans. I think it's they've always seemed interesting to me in the sense that amidst this very male-centric, frankly, phallocentric culture, you get these little eddies of female power. So to have, you know, we have our third member of our podcast is Vicky Noble, and she has a concept of the double goddess and the double queenship.
Yes.
And that we see that I've always thought it was interesting. We see that in Sparta with the double kingship, because that's very unusual and seems to have been borrowed from that. But that similarly, they're also, you know, you have women are allowed to be physically active and there's educated amidst this patriarchy. So it's interesting that this goddess, this great goddess also shows up there. I was not aware of that. What has the record told you about how that became part of Spartan culture or why that is part of Spartan culture?
So that's an interesting question. I'm not sure that primary sources actually answer that question, to be quite honest with you. I think a lot of that has to be our own interpretation, which sometimes, of course, then shows our bias. But I do, when you say that, I think also of the Amazons, which we were talking about, there seems to be a connection between like a warrior or a patriarchal elite of men, let's say like a military culture that is fascinated with strong, powerful warrior women, you know? there seems to, you know, so the Amazons I kind of see as sort of a fetish of the Athenians, you know, like they, mm-hmm. they're obsessed with conquering these women that are also warriors, and they depict them in art and everywhere. And I think the Spartans have a similar sort of idea that there's something in that military perhaps mindset that about strength and competition and, you know, empowerment. And so I think Artemis fits them because she holds a lot of that space, right? Mm-hmm. She is someone that you want to have at your back in a fight.
Yes.
She is independent. She is wrathful when she needs to be. And so it doesn't surprise me. I mean, it surprised me that I didn't know about it before, that I had never learned about it before. And it never really comes up when you talk about the Spartans. When you read a little piece on the Spartans here and there, they don't go, oh yeah, and they worshiped Artemis. And so you have to kind of dig to find that out, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't surprise me, but it did surprise me how bloody their rituals for her were. In fact, I would argue that other than the Taurian Artemis, where we are told that bulls were sacrificed to her and the blood of the bull was poured over her cult statue, other than that Artemis, I would say that the Spartan ritual for Artemis is the bloodiest and the longest lasting bloodiest in the area of Greece. And so, and they would do this sometimes. They, you know, they would bleed themselves before a fight, before they would go off to war. The young women that raced or were in the gymnasium or fought with the boys were often the daughters of Artemis. And they often wore those short skirts that Artemis wears in the sculptures. Mm-hmm. So a long association between whatever Artemis defined for them, which I think is strength, power, competition, you know, those kinds of things, and the values of their community, right? They were quite progressive. I mean, feeding their women, you know, there was this whole fight between the Athenians and the Spartans about how much women should eat, and the Spartans were feeding their women. They were allowing them to have children later on in life so that they could have infants that lived longer and they wouldn't die in childbirth. Spartan women could have two or three husbands, right? Yes, thank you. Darn, that's right. The chiton.
Either the chiton or the peplos. Yeah.
How sad is it that we say they were allowed. They were progressive to eat that they would feed.
You're right. Oh my god.
Just amazing. It tells you everything you want to know.
Yes. You're absolutely right, because there's debates, you know, in primary text about how much women should eat.
Amazing.
And the Spartans were pointed out as, oh, they let their women eat so much food.
Good God.
A man's ration is the way they say it. Like, oh, wow. God.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. All I can say is I'm glad that women were preparing the food, because that way, if they were being underfed, they could sneak some in the process of preparation. But you mentioned that Spartan women had multiple husbands. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes. So Spartan women were allowed to marry two or more husbands. And so what they often did was they would marry an older husband who was finished war and had some money, and a younger husband who would be, I don't want to say used, but who would take part in the procreation of children. And this was because so many men died. And so the children were of that union, let's say one woman, two men, would have protection, both financial, economical protection, but also protection of the older father that was now, let's say, retired. But the vigorous prowess of the young men,
the virility,
would allow them to have more children, you know, so they would have more children. Famously so. And in fact, one of my favorite rituals, and Sarah Pomeroy talks about this in her book, is that if Spartan women had a good and satisfying evening with their husband, one or two, whoever, they would let down their hair when they went into the into the market the next day. And so letting down your hair was a way of letting other people know that you had a good time the night before.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Letting the other women know. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They were very, you know, they were very fascinating for their time, I think.
I think someone needs to look into some matriarchal connection with Sparta, because there's just too many things that show up in that way. It's just odd.
But yeah, it is fascinating. It really feels like Sparta is like this constant sort of battle between, you know, let's take the matriarchy, but let's make it dude-centric. And then, but we love our women, but the dudes, man! You know, I mean, it's it's weird.
It's like they had a matriarchy and kind of took it over and then decided, well, we'll keep some aspects, or they couldn't let go of certain. It's odd. It is. There's something there. That's for research in the future, I'm sure.
There you go.
I agree. I agree.
There you go.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's definitely worth looking into.
Well, what are some other regions you would like to highlight for the listeners?
As far as the temples of Artemis,
do you have any favorites?
Yeah, what are your favorites?
Well, my favorite is Buron, for sure. My all-time favorite is Buron. I think it's often undervisited, so I always try to plug it because...
Where's that?
I think it's just outside of Athens. It's about an hour outside of Athens. And I like it because it's a temple totally dedicated to Artemis, and it still has pieces that are standing. So, you know, sometimes people want to go and see something too. I like to go even if there's five rocks on the ground. But and the museum that's attached to it is full of pieces to Artemis. So I think if someone's an Artemis enthusiast, this would be the place to really start. Other than that, I would say Epidaurus is a surprisingly lovely site. It is mostly known for Aeschylus. But Aeschylus and Artemis are often attached. And again, this is another mystery of Artemis, because Aeschylus is the god of healing. This place in Epidaurus is a sanctuary for Aeschylus, where people would go if they were sick, if they were ill. And yet there is a temple to Artemis, and only Artemis, other than Aeschylus, of course, on the site.
That's fascinating.
And so... Again, so what does she have to do with healing? Why is she at the sanctuary? What would people have gone into her temple for if they're there to get better, you know? So this may play into her savior role, in the sense that people believe that she did have the ability to heal and save, both in the afterlife and in this life. So that's another great thing.
Yeah, it also might play into her as the guardian of childbirth, because, you know, childbirth is an extremely dangerous medical event. So,
yes, there's also a small temple for her right on the Acropolis, which I don't think that people go visit when they're there. And I'm not sure how well it's labeled, because both times I've gone there, I was really filming other pieces, but I myself did not see it. So I don't know if it's standing, but there is a small temple to Artemis on the site there. And it was a place where it was said that women would come and offer their scarves. So there was, you know, they found all these scarves, remnants of all these scarves, where women offered their scarves or sometimes other piece of clothing in protection. Now, we assume protection for children, again, assumptions, or some kind of protection or a thank you. But it was something. So it was because it was at this very popular site. Imagine that all the people that went up there also paused at the Temple of Artemis.
Right.
And so to me, that says, well, she must have been particularly popular to build this piece for her, where people would stop on the way to you know, to the larger piece of Athena and things like that. So that's an interesting, and I would love to, when I go back now to Greece, to see, but you know, sometimes it gets a little hectic, so you got to find a good empty day.
There's so much. Yeah.
Right. Take some pictures and things. And so I like to travel in the winter and see. But there is one temple to Artemis right across from the Temple of Zeus in Athens that is covered up with a tarp. And has been covered up with a tarp for about 10 years. People began digging it, and it is still being processed. So this is what I mean about there are different temples to her that are not, that are recorded, but are not, you know, on a visitor list.
Right.
And so people don't know. And so I would really like to create this map. So if you're somewhere in Greece or somewhere in Sicily or wherever you are, and you go, oh, I might want to visit an Artemis temple, you can turn to that and be like, let's see what's around me. And you know, and go see. I have not been to Sicily yet, but I heard that there are tons of spaces for Artemis Diana there, tons of temples in Sicily. And so that will be another book in this series.
Wow. We can see why you're going to need a series.
So many. Yeah, there's so many things and we'll have to certainly have you back to talk about. I do want to ask before we close up about one region that I've sort of discovered Dawn and I both have kind of stumbled onto in terms of its goddesses. And sometimes I see a little connection to Artemis that's mentioned, which is Thrace. Is there anything to point out about sort of the Thracians and their connection to her?
Yes. So the Thracians are my favorite. Oh my God, John. The Thracians are my favorite because
they're becoming my favorite too, just so you know.
Right? And I have already a book title for that, Artemis in the Balkans, you know, for that whole area and region, not just the Thracians. But because they blend into what is today Balkans or Eastern Europe eventually, or so we're told, they have a hunter goddess. And there is some overlap there with Artemis Bendis.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard of Artemis Bendis, but she has right? The Thracian
mm-hmm.
cap.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes, absolutely 100%. And Artemis Bendis also comes out of Mesopotamia. And so there is this, I have not yet followed the route because I'm three books behind. But I was born and raised in Romania. So this summer I'm going to spend a month back home with my cousin, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to go to the museums in Romania and perhaps Bulgaria, you know, Eastern Europe, and see if they have any pieces of Artemis Bendis or Bendis. Because sometimes they call her just Bendis.
Bendis, right. Like
Artemis. So I think that is absolutely fascinating. I've fallen down that rabbit hole a few times and I kind of, you know, you save those articles that you find so that, okay, I'll read them when I get there. But yes, absolutely, Sean, there will be a connection with Artemis. So if you think about the geographical space, if we start in Mesopotamia, we go into Anatolia, the Mediterranean, and now we go up, you know, into Europe. I mean, that's a massive space for this goddess to adapt to each different culture and time period. And I recognize she's not the only one, but I'm going to argue that she is the most popular one that maintains her attributes and name throughout, you know? We'll see. I mean, someone who, you know, might love Persephone or others might say, Carla, please sit down. I'll talk about it. You know what I mean? Not everyone's going to agree with me. But for me, yeah. I see it as a lifetime commitment, you know, because this is going to take some time. But that's all right. Like, I'm very resolved to, I feel like on a spiritual level, I feel like this is my calling. This is what I've been called to do. This is what she wants from me.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of confirmation as I go to places where she'll show up or an article or an exhibition or something will come across my lap that I wasn't thinking she was there. And I'll be like, okay, I hear you. I got it.
Nice.
So I feel like she's almost like, you know, say my name kind of thing. It's time, you know, it's time to remember me. And so, so I feel pretty blessed to be on this path. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, on that note.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you so much for coming and talking Artemis with us. We are thrilled. As we have said many times, she is one of our favorites. So Yeah, yes. We're so glad to have you and your incredible breadth of knowledge on the podcast with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
And thank you, Dawn Sam Alden, as always.
Thank you, Sean Marlon Newcomb, for being our manifester.
And we thank you all for listening. This has been the 34 Circe Salon, the Make Matriarchy Great Again podcast. We'll be back again very soon. Take care.
Take care, everyone, and blessed be.